This is Richard Roth. The show is The Passage. In a few minutes, we'll be listening to an interview with Bruno Pasquier de Vigna and Mike Gladstone. But to start off, here is some music, Fred Neil with Everybody's Talking.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear a word they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. People stopping, staring, I can't see the faces, only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keep shining through the pouring rain, going where the weather suits my clothes, banking off of the northeast wind, sailing on a summer breeze, skipping over the ocean like a stone. Northeast wind, sailing on a summer breeze, skipping over the ocean like a stone. Everybody's talking at me, can't hear a word they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. I won't let you leave my love behind. No, I won't let you leave my love behind. I won't let you leave my love behind.
That was Fred Neil. Bruno Pasquier de Vigna is a French-born artist who spent his summers in Hamlet near Hudson since the mid-1970s, where he's filled a large house and a studio and a garden with artwork, ranging from fine paintings to gazebos made out of old-style satellite dishes. Bruno is friends with James Ivory, the filmmaker, and has contributed to Merchant Ivory Films in a way which you will hear later on. He's also led workshops at the Hudson Opera House in Integrarte, which you're also going to hear about. Joining us is Bruno's friend Mike Gladstone, who is an editor at Merriam-Webster and McGraw-Hill, among other places. He's served on the New York State Council on the Arts. He edited a book published by the Columbia County Historical Society a year or two ago called Looking for Work, which is a lavishly illustrated industrial archaeology of Columbia County, New York. He is affiliated with, furthermore, the foundation established by Joan Davidson to provide grants in nonfiction publishing. So here is the interview. This is Richard Roth. I'm here with my sidekick, Ellen Thurston, and our guests, Mike Gladstone and Bruno Pasquier de Vigna. Ellen, would you have a question for Bruno?
Well, I think, first of all, I'd like to tell you about my introduction to Bruno, and that is that in Mike Gladstone's house, there's a connection between all of us. In Mike Gladstone's house were these funny little wire people or objects that were made from the wires that come off champagne corks. And I said, what are these? Well, they turned out to be little sculptures that Bruno had made. And so that was my introduction to Bruno.
Now, this goes back some years.
It does. I came here 16 years ago. And Bruno, when did you arrive?
In 1975. 75 means 35, 36 years ago.
And where did you come from?
We were coming from Jamaica at that point. We were looking for a house, and we found that one, and we stayed there for 35 years.
How did you happen to come to Columbia County, of all places you might have gone looking for a house?
A friend of a friend of a friend of a friend who had a friend who had a house to sell. That's about it. And we arrived, and we didn't want the house, because the house was falling apart, and they said, but it's a good house, it just needs love and care. Yeah. And here we go.
And you moved into the house full time at that point then?
Never. That house is not winter tight. In fact, it has, it's very, very big, and it has no heat at all. So it's a summer house, it's a summer camp in effect. And we lived in Jamaica for a long time, and now we live in winter, we go to France.
France, where you originally came
yes,
from,
I'm French,
before you became the peripatetic couple that you became.
That's it.
Then you brought your friend Mike Gladstone to this area.
That's exactly it. So Mike, that I knew before, was visiting us, and then we decided it was a very good place. And Mike will tell you what he thinks.
Well, I think you said it. I didn't know Columbia County before. However, I think I was introduced to Columbia County by working for the New York State Council on the Arts, and I, at that time, acted periodically as a field representative, going to see institutions here that were applying to the Council for grants. And it was my introduction to New York State, which was filled with great surprises for me. I was about as, let's say, ill-informed an Easterner as I could be about New York State and its diversity and its marvelous geography and its incredible history. And Columbia County, of course, is just explicit example of all those things. So I was already fascinated by Columbia County before I came across, through visiting here, a very old house which I had known about before and which was surprisingly for sale and at a very, very low price. That's why I'm beginning here.
I believe you said the same thing, Bruno, that your house was available at a very low price at the time.
The house was impossible to sell because it was too big and it was falling apart, and people with children needed somebody else, so, and it was impossible to do. So for us, it was so cheap that we had to buy it, and then for 40 years we have been working at it.
And building a beautiful garden around it too, incredible garden.
My wife is a very good gardener and likes gardens, and she has made lots of gardens, one of them being a maze where you just lose yourself.
Now, I'm particularly interested in Hudson and the history of Hudson. And in those days, 35 years ago, what was Hudson like?
A dump.
A dump.
It was fantastically dumping, to the degree that you could not walk on the sidewalk. And there was nothing much there except very old shops, which were very nice, full of people, very old also, who were selling their wares. And then eventually they died off, and then everything changed completely.
Was that about the time the cement industry disappeared? Or was
it was already gone. So it had fallen down completely. There was nothing gone at all. And we thought it was wonderful, you know, with all those, all, if you remember Rogerson, Rogerson was the best stores of them all, you see, yeah? There were other stores which were just wonderfully funky, full of junk of the 19th century, which was for sale and which I bought very much to make artifacts.
You're talking about Rogerson's hardware store,
yeah,
which is still hanging on by a thread, I think, on
Warren
Street.
It's
still there.
Yes, yeah. Well, Rogerson was really the best of all the stores, you know. The rest, there was nothing at all. You went there from potholes to potholes, and then it was wonderful because it was very cheap also.
And at that time you were already working in the style that you use now of assemblages. Is that true?
No. I change style like I change shirts.
I see.
So, no, I have changed my style a deal since I've been here, but, you know.
I just wondered if the kind of junk you were buying, how that turned up in your work.
Oh, not junk, Richard. Found objects.
Found objects.
That's it. It's a magic. Junk has been expurged.
Mike, when you arrived, what was and what year was that, and what was Hudson like?
Well, very interestingly, when I arrived in Germantown, which was 1987, I was only dimly aware of Hudson. And I became aware of Hudson because of the need to get to a hospital in an ambulance, and discovered this city of sorts that was there and that had a really very good restaurant, which was the old Charleston restaurant, and came back to Hudson to go to the Charleston restaurant, I think, for the next year or two, but was, for that period, curiously unaware of the city itself. I was aware of the hospital and the Charleston, and didn't give much thought to it, until, I can't remember how, I became involved in the evolving Hudson Opera House. So I don't remember what led me into the central group that ultimately became the board of the Hudson Opera House and worked to make it a possibility. And that I say from this prejudiced point of view, I still think is largely responsible for the re-evolution of the city. I think the Opera House has played just an incredible role continuously from that time on in what's happened here, both because of its program, its wonderful director, and its physical presence. Remember, it was a derelict building at that point, and there it is in all its spruceness now, and with wonderful programs like exhibition, which Vermeule's work is featured in introductory part now, and wonderful, it seems to me, programs that involve children, and certainly that is an art program which might well involve children, and some of the other things that really involve people and attract people of all age groups and all interests. But it is part of the city, I think, and an expression of what the city
and a kind of anchor.
I think so. And there are many other great things. I misunderstand that.
Was Carol Clark running the...
Yes, it was Carol Clark. And there again is really an astonishing performance that should not be forgotten as we think the evolution of this really lively city that we have now.
Ellen, what was Hudson like when you came?
Well, I came probably 1993, 94. I had a house on the other side of the river, and I knew Mike Gladstone because we had worked together at the New York State Council on the Arts, and he persuaded me to join the advisory board of the Opera House. So I was on this side of the river more often than before, and finally bought a house right in the heart of Hudson, which surprisingly is like living in the jungle because of the animals that come on my property to feast. But that was about 1995, and at that time when I came, there were 60 antique stores, on or near Warren Street. So it was at the beginning of this transformation where antique dealers had discovered the buildings on Warren Street, which they could acquire for pretty low price at that point. When I arrived, you could still buy a house in Hudson for $60,000 or $80,000, a pretty good house that might require some work, but that was not, my house was not like that. But the prices were beginning to go up, and but still very affordable, especially to people from the metropolitan New York area who saw them as very reasonable. And the city was, as I said, at the beginning of this transformation. But, it, you know, it has such beautiful historic architecture that even if some of the houses were in a sort of faded condition, you could see that the real beauty was there. So that's what attracted a lot of people to come here.
How did the antiques start to arrive? I mean, were there one or two shops originally?
Well, I think it was a man named Byrne Fone, who was an antique dealer, who had a central antique for a kind of market in which, even before the antique dealers were buying buildings, that they could have suits for their material. And I think that he and his partner were really very instrumental in building the whole antique picture. It was not there in any way at the time that I came, excepting for Byrne Fone and maybe one or two other sort of old junk shops, largely. You know, I want to go back, though, to what I was saying about programs for children and say that one of the programs, it seems to me, that the Opera House has mounted and persisted in running year after year is a program that Bruno started there, you know, and it's a great example of extending out to children. Going back to the early days, it wasn't antique shoppers. It was children very largely who sort of went unshepherded down Warren Street, and one wondered what was going to happen to those kids, what they were going to do next. And British programs, one, it seems to me, excellent example of what can be done to bring children off the street and into the Opera House, but more important than that, to really introduce them to the whole idea of what art and expression is in a way that that seems to me they would not be likely to think of otherwise. And
yes, Bruno, maybe you could tell us a little bit about that program. Yes, Bruno, maybe you could tell us a little bit about that program.
The idea of Indigarte has started in South America, where I was, and I was discovered by a guy who was very, very, very rich, and who says, I have a dream, which is to make social integration through trash. And I said, won't work. So, and he said, let's try. And we tried. And the first three months later, we were in the Museum of Modern Art in Santiago. And we were so impressed that he said, well, if it worked that much in 3 months, let's try to do it around the country. So we did it around Chile, then Peru, then Argentina for 7 years. And it worked. Wonders, 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 everywhere we went. So when I came back here, I tried it here and it worked wonders. I am trying to France again just now, and Clarkson does it where I go.
Explain a little bit just what that is, Intricate.
You take cardboard, plastic bottles, whatever it is, and you give that to people and say, well, amuse yourself, and paint also, lots of paint. And amuse yourself and create whatever object that you want, and if you don't like it, trash it, it's trash anyway. See? Well, it is no longer trash, it is magic, because you give them the capacity of doing something which has really no value to them at the very beginning, but when they have done it, they say, mine, it's wonderful, I can do that, I'm an artist, and they all do it. It's extraordinary, and it works from Punta Arenas, which is way down in Patagonia, to France, in the same way. The same reaction from everybody, from the kids, from the grandmother, from wherever it is, from the rich, from the poor, but to work well, you have to mix the ages, the capacity of the rich, the poor, the learned, the downtrodden, everybody has to be mixed, and the mix works. If you do it for children, it doesn't work. If you do it for geriatric, it doesn't work. If you do it for the rich, it doesn't work. But if the rich, the poor, everybody is together, there is a kind of compulsion to work better than the guy who is rich, who is poor, whatever it is. And eventually, everybody speaks to each other, and it is social integration by accident. And it takes about months. You have to have them about four times. The first time to look at it. Mm-hmm. The second time to say, I can do it. The third time to say, I can do it. And the fourth time, they don't want to talk about me. They want to be there singing. It's wonderful.
I think you're leaving out of an important part of what it is. And what, if I may say this, it is that out of out of the corner of a box easily comes a mask, you see, or a soda bottle becomes a fish, or a pie plate becomes a bird, and it is really the potential of the most ordinary, easily accessible object to become a something, and as often as not an anthropomorphic. Something, and that's very exciting. You see that not only can you make a bottle into a bird or a fish, but it can be really a very good one. And then it comes, I think, as a large surprise for many.
To everybody, and to me too.
But it's true. It comes as a surprise to you at this point.
What surprised me is that I did not believe in the project. And I was given that project by a guy who was speaking French and English and Spanish and whatever it is. I spoke whatever, but not Spanish. And he said, well, it's not that much, you know. And then eventually I did it for 7 years. And I speak Spanish now, but at the beginning, you know. The fact of giving that kind of capacity to anybody to recognize a bottle, a fish in a bottle, or whatever else.
Yes, I'd say it's to recognize it almost, to bring it magically out of its cage.
It's a magic, and the magic is perfect. And great.
I might point out at this point that the kaleidoscope that greets people at the top of the steps of the Opera House right now includes some fish, and I noticed someone taking a particular delight in the fact that there was a girl fish and a boy fish.
Good.
This is, I might say, in an exhibition called Warren Street, which is at the Opera House now, and has been curated by Richard Roth, and has artwork from a number of different artists in Columbia County, and photographs by Lynn Davis of Warren Street. How long is the exhibition?
It's up until the middle of August, 14th of August.
Oh, great.
And it's a sort of chronicle of Warren Street, actually, through various forms of art.
Yeah. No, it's wonderful. It's a very good exhibit. I was looking at it just before I came just now, and was there looking at those photographs. They are extraordinary.
We're going to change them at the end of this week and put two different sets, so you'll be able to look at a different part of Warren Street for the rest of the show. Apparently, this being Hudson, there were people who complained about a bias toward Upper Warren Street.
Well, you know, Lower Warren Street is really expanding the business district now in Hudson. When the Opera House opened, there were a lot of empty storefronts in the 300 block. And now there are no empty storefronts in the 300 block. And the city is thinking they have to put parking meters down there. I mean, it was really a part of town that people sort of approached with some fear and trepidation. That has all changed now. So when you think of the Opera House, as Mike was describing, as a sort of anchor, they talk about anchors, downtown anchors a lot. This is a really good example of how it has succeeded. And then the organization called Below Third came into being, and they were trying to get people, encourage people to go below Third. But if there's not much happening down there, people don't go down there. It's a whole different story now. There's a little restaurant called Bruno's, or a takeout place, no relation to the Bruno who's sitting here, and a French bakery, several restaurants. The store Dakota has opened, from Chatham, has opened another store here in Hudson. There's a dog grooming place called the Pampered Pooch, I believe. And the Chamber of Commerce and the Hudson Development Corporation have moved into the old Washington Hose Firehouse at the foot of Promenade Hill. So things continue to evolve and look up, and we're seeing some development on Front Street now also.
But you know, this business of evolution is so strange, however, because if you think back to certainly the moment in which I came in Hudson, there was a museum in Lower Warren Street, the American Revolution, historic house, which was open to the public, and it seems to me that visitors to Hudson were curiously unaware of the fact that anything of the sort might exist down there, you know, and that here it is, places called Bruno's, you say, and other cuter names.
It's a museum of the imagination. I've never been in it, but it's right there.
Oh, it's right there. And he hasn't been putting on any shows lately, but he has wonderful exhibitions.
I've never been there, but you see, I just passed this morning, so it's I tried a lot. It's always closed when I'm there, but anyway. And we did not speak about Elena and Greg Mosley, who are the salt of the earth, and the people who have really made such a contribution to the development of Lower of Hudson, not Lower Hudson, of all of Hudson, and what they do for the kids is just beyond anything that you can.
Now, they were among the original, sort of originators of the Opera House.
Yes, I was going to say that the Elena has been, from the very beginning, a very, very important factor in what the program was and its success.
I just wanted to ask Bruno some questions about his artwork. He, to me, one definition of an artist is somebody who must make art no matter what. And Bruno, you make me think of that.
You miss the point. It's a way of life. It's not a must, it's a way of life. You do it because you do it. And you are not a stackonomist of work. You just do naturally, like you go and you cook and do whatever it is, and you make the garden, and then you make a pretty painting or a blog, whatever, you know, and then hopefully the blob becomes a pretty painting, and hopefully it becomes magic and it's wonderful. But otherwise you don't go after the magic, you see, you just hope that it will come.
That's wonderful. What I knew Bruno also through someone else. It's not 6 degrees of separation. It's more like 2, I think. But our mutual friend Lucille Rhodes was involved in making a film with Bruno. Tell us about that, if you can.
As you know, you don't know because he's dead, but you knew probably Ismail Merchan.
Oh, yes, yes.
And Ismail was having dinner with us once and said you should make a film about all your little things you do with corks and toothpicks, and I'll make it for you. So, here we go. We are making the Song of Roland, which is the army of the Franks and the army of the Arabs, which are the fighting in South Spain or whatever. We have all that done, and Ismail says, I have no time. So, your friend
Lucille
comes in and says, oh, I love it, I'll do it. So here comes Lucille, and with Lucille we made the epic of the years, which is La Chanson de Roland, the Song of Roland, which is wonderful.
These were armies made out of corks and toothpicks.
Now, that's it.
That's how we met.
Can we see this movie?
Oh yes. Anytime. I ran it non-stop all winter long in France because I had 3 shows in France running, and one of them had the Song of Roland running in the show, and another show had the film which is Out of the Box, which is about me, which is whatever, but I mean which exists.
And how did you become the hands of Picasso?
Because, again, Ismail and Jim, being our friends from day one when we arrived here, were looking for somebody who could do things that a la Picasso, because the film they were doing was surviving Picasso, which means not, it was against Picasso, so that the Picasso people did not want any of Picasso's things to be done. So that they look at our own and say, well, you can do it. And I said, maybe, I don't know. So I became the hands of Picasso, which is the hands of Anthony Hopkins. It was great fun to do, I must say. I don't know what the film is, but the film, the making of the film was wonderful.
Well, I think you're leaving that the Quentin really is an extraordinary draftsman. That is to say, his ability to capture the linear quality and the contour of whatever he is looking at is so deft and fast. And it seems to me in the whole spectrum of modern art, the only figure whose work is immediately called to mind is Pablo Picasso and his drawings of figures. Which linear drawings are really extraordinary, like linear drawings of yours. I wonder if you go on. The other is that Bruno curiously does not only respond to cardboard boxes, but he has responded not to material all the time, but really to what he's seen. The first works of Bruno's that I ever saw were fish drawings or fish paintings, and they were largely Caribbean fish, most beautifully colored things that one has ever seen. So I thought of him first as a fish painter, not as a box maker, and that has changed. He has responded to different things at different times. His paintings of flowers are really remarkable paintings of just autumnal landscape and what the total coloration of what he's confronting is. It's just straight reaction to what he has seen or what the material suggests. And then in the same way that many of us think of Picasso, that he works in that same reactive manner, which is, it seems to me, the most basic component of artistic response.
Now, I saw some of those paintings in the catalog from your retrospective. Have you shown them in the Hudson, any of the paintings and drawings?
All what you've seen in the catalog was made in France or was in France. I did not take anything from here to France, so everything that you've seen is from France, but if you go to the studio, you see all that I did here. And what was in France was all done before 75, because since 75, I worked and stocked everything here. Before, I was stocking the thing in France because my parents had a bigger house, and then I took everything there, and then eventually my sister just got the house, and I had all those things just stocked in her house. And so when I was making those exhibits in France this year, I just went and picked what I had, which was 1975. That's about it. So if I made a retrospective here, it would be completely different, because there is much more to see, and it's very difficult to choose whatever. But if you have to do something in France, you take what you have, and here what you have, and hope for the best.
I just want to proceed on this point. There's been some outside of the exhibitions in France, there has been recognition of Brunet's works and other points. He's had a marvelous exhibition of his work, which occupied the entire waiting room, the seated waiting room of Grand Central Station at one point. And he has also had, I think it was Cartier's Windows 1 year after Christmas. What's the say? So there have been levels of visibility in this country outside of Hudson.
When was the Grand Central show?
In 95. In 95, somebody just conked out, and again through Ismail, Ismail said to somebody who was in Canzanal, the guy who was having that exhibit count product, and he said, oh, well, ask Bruno. And so I went, and I did it. With bicycle wheels and whatever. It was very amusing.
That brings another thing that we haven't spoken about, and that, I think, was the first public viewing of Bruno as the bicyclist, because from that point on, a great many of Bruno's certainly larger works really proceeded from bicycles or parts of bicycles. And in fact, he became involved not only with the form of the bicycle and all its components, which incidentally lead to the kaleidoscope, which is right on view at the Opera House, but also, I don't think that we should let go of the fact that he's been fascinated by the music that can be made by simply holding a metal rod against a spinning bike wheel.
Well, there's a few CDs of bicycle music, bicycle music.
Oh, you must bring some here.
I think you might like to get one here.
Yeah, we have a shelf of local music over there.
Oh, yes, I do you one.
And you know, Bruno, Hudson's becoming now its next phase, a real music town, and there are lots of places where music can be played now, so you might want to bring your bicycle and get in on the act.
It is not the most musical of all instruments, but it is very amusing to play.
Wait a second, there has been a very famous bicycle wheel concert at the Garden of the Museum of Modern Art, so places to go.
Well, we can try anyway.
Well, this radio station has more what is called transmission art than any station in the entire country, from midnight until 6 a.m. every day, Saturdays. Original music, such as music performed on or invented on bicycles.
I'll bring you a CD and you will see if you like it.
What else would you like to tell us, Bruno?
I see that they shot my bolt, you know, I don't know. What else? I don't know. South America was good because in 1959, I drove a car from Colombia to Patagonia, and we paid for the trip with paintings. I was with an American. And we organized a big exhibit in Buenos Aires. And 50 years later, the guy who had organized it in Buenos Aires had become the head of a huge Centro Cultural Borges.
And say that again, please.
Centro Cultural Borges. And he invited me. He had just got the center, and he wanted to fill it up, and he said, you can do it. And I came there with my cutters and nothing else. And that is where I made a huge thing, which called Cartón Fabulosos. And Cartón Fabulosos became the key of Integrarte, because the guy who saw it said, if you can do that by yourself, you can do that and really produce something else. And that is the beginning of social integration throughout. That's it. So that is very important to me, but not it's important because it was one of the seminal exhibits, while something like what happened in New York fell down and nothing happened of it, you see. Well, what happened in South America was really surprising.
And it is that Bruno is a self-taught artist, and he has really reinvented what he is doing again and again, largely in response to a particular material or a particularly distinctive visual phenomenon. So he invents a way of responding, as I said, to autumn foliage, you say, or a way of, at one point he got some sheet copper and just started a whole new band of wonderful silhouette figures of sheet copper. And the same thing, it's been some material or some phenomenon that he responds to and finds, as far as I'm concerned, a perfect form to really capture the essence of the magic or the attractiveness or the mystery of what it is that he's confronting. And it changes for all these things. There was a whole period when he went to wonderful jazz concerts.
Oh,
what was
yes.
the name of that?
It was
Matley Land's jazz.
It was a Dixieland jazz group that played every year at Jackson's Steakhouse. And Bruno would sit there with a pen and a drawing pad and just do one drawing after another. Yes. Absolutely wonderful. You know, you saw the essence of these performers.
How long have you been making art?
I was born in it and I never stopped. In fact, I am trying to explain that the way of life. It's the problem with there is two ways of looking at it. Either to make a product which sells on it, which sells for millions, or you work at it and you play with it. Well, if you play with it, you are not going to make a fortune, but you are going to have a fantastic life. You won't be recognized by anybody because you change your style all the time and they want a style. Well, too bad. It's much more fun to do what Mike explained, to play with what you have in your hand and then to make it. And then nothing is perfect and nothing is ever perfect, but it's always fun and interesting. And if you try for a masterpiece, you are fine, because you are trapped into thinking that you have to produce something wonderful. You won't. But maybe you will, in the pile of things that you have done, some will be good and some will be in effect, you change all the time. There is no way of, if you try to find a style and you skip and you keep to that style, you are bored or sunk or whatever it is, but you are not going to go very much in the spirit of art. The spirit of art is to make something alive and fun. Or maybe the essence of things. You can go and try to be profound, but I am not. I think that it's a way of dealing with life, with things that you have at hand. That's
well, you know, I think the problem may be the word art. And again, going back to the self-taught nature of Brinton does, and almost the instinctive reaction. And I think the parallel that might be useful is looking at early cave drawings of bison and deer in France or in Spain, and thinking how beautiful they are. And they are, and so they're beautiful just in just what the economy of the form is, and the exactness with which both the physicality of the creature is there, but there it is, the beauty of the creature is there. And you wonder, at least I wonder when I look at those things, could the man who was doing this, or the woman who was doing this, could they be thinking of it in terms of art? Well, it seems very unlikely. You see, or did they say that is beautiful, that is exquisite, or did they just say that's perfect?
No, but they looked at the shape and they recognized it. They recognized the shape. That is exactly what Picasso was saying. I never looked for. I find, and that is so true. You find, you don't look for it, but. But you see the bison into the rock, he's there. And those people found it.
Exactly.
They found it, and Picasso had that kind of reaction to it. He said, ooh, I find it, you know. And then he found a baboon into a little car. The car was there, and the baboon is there, you see. You know the one I'm talking about. It is that type of recognition which makes life fun, you see, and which I think is make too hard, because if you try to be in to make a minimalist art of whatever, you know, you take a knife and then you do that into a canvas and you say, I sign, why not? I don't really care. But it is wanting.
Well, there's a large space here called Basilica Industria. Maybe sometime you could make an installation there.
Where is that?
That's down by the train station.
Oh, that huge thing, yes. I see. Oh, I could, yes, I'm for sure.
You could fill the whole space, you know.
Let's get to work on this house.
Okay.
Well, I guess we'll wrap it up there. Mike Gladstone, Renaud Pasquier-Levin, Helen Thurston, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, there you have it. That was Bruno Pasquier-Levin with Mike Gladstone and Helen Thurston. Bruno is a truly wonderful artist. I hope everyone who's listening can go to the Opera House and see the kaleidoscope that he has installed there. He's constantly inventing. After we made this tape the other day, we went over to the park falafel, and as soon as lunch was finished, Bruno began making a construction out of a paper plate and a paper cup and a straw and a napkin and his pen and ink. And his house is full of things like a huge series made out of Filippo Berio olive oil cans, the armies of Charlemagne and the Saracens made out of champagne corks, which were then made into this 11-minute movie called The Song of Roland, which I hope to be able to link on our website here at WGXC. It's It's a wonderful piece. Bruno is friends with Richard Robbins, who wrote many of the soundtracks for Merchant and Ivory movies, including Surviving Picasso, where Bruno played, Bruno's hands were used for Anthony Hopkins while he was painting. Here are three selections from the soundtrack of Surviving Picasso. First is called Grandmother, the second is called Jacqueline, and the third is Circus.
Thank you.
This is Richard Roth. Please come back the third Thursday of next month.
Hello, you are listening to WGA.